That for ABKT 444 in amendments to Supreme Court Rule 111, and then we'll follow that with ABKT 525 amendments to Supreme Court Rule 116. Mr. Hunter, welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we have Mr. Leverty's here, President Leverty, and Janine Isaac is here also.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court that Your Honor has noted our President Gene Leverty is here. The Board of Governors is today petitioning the court in two separate matters. One is a change in the reporting protocols for convictions of misdemeanors pursuant to Rule 111, and then the Board of Governors is also petitioning the court for a change in the wording of the reinstatement rule, Supreme Court Rule 116. I consider these both to be modest, appropriate steps forward that have been the subject of discussions among the Board of Governors and among the members of this court, starting with Rule 111. I think we all pretty much came to the conclusion, at least I did, in one of my first weeks with the State Bar, and we got an order back from the court in response to our Rule 111 petition, which said you don't have to do anything with this. And I thought that was rather surprising. I thought we ought to be doing something with it. So I asked, and they said, yeah, they send most of them back. I said, so why do we send them up in the first place? And the answer was, because the rule says. Well, you know, we all live and learn. This is not a terribly burdensome thing on our office or the court, but the fact of the matter is we could all have better things to do. So even though it's not a large number of cases, what we're doing is petitioning to change the rule to follow the ABA standard, where we're not so much looking at felony versus misdemeanor and those kinds of things. We're looking at whether or not the conviction reflects badly and adversely on the lawyer's ability to practice law. And if we focus on that, then I think we'll be sending fewer cases up here. That will give you fewer cases to process. So I don't think that the change in Supreme Court Rule 111 is any more complicated than that. If the conviction as a misdemeanor does not reflect adversely on the attorney's ability to practice law, then we don't really need to deal with it. And the distinction between felonies and misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors and all that kind of stuff, which is appropriate to the wide body of criminal law in that area applied to everybody, really doesn't need to be applied. What we as your bar need to suggest an answer to, and what you need to have the answer to, is does this criminal conviction adversely affect this lawyer's ability to practice law? With that, unless there are questions for myself or Mr. Leverty, we can either take comments from Las Vegas, if we have them, questions from the court, or we can move on to Rule 116.
Questions from anybody?
I have a brief question. Would a petty theft, that is not involving the attorney's trust account fit within the reporting requirement under the new rule or not, in your judgment?
That's a tough one. I frankly hadn't thought of that, but I would, in the absence of a case like that, revert to our purpose. Does it adversely affect the attorney's ability to practice law? And for that, we're going to have to get into the case. Was it a shoplifting case? Was it negotiated down? Was it perhaps precipitated by the use of drugs or alcohol? So I couldn't rule that one in or out.
Well, Mike, the reason I posed that question, and I was interested in your thoughts on this, is whether instead of a standard that talks about whether it reflects on the attorney's fitness, if the misdemeanor reflects on a crime of moral turpitude, that's what would be concerning to me.
Yes, and us too. So again, it would not be the label that we'd be sending up. It would be the conduct. You know, when did he go to trial on the misdemeanor? Does he have a defense? Is there, as I said, an underlying problem? So this, for better or worse, is not the cure-all. Changing the words doesn't let you all out of the ultimate decision-making process. But I think it makes the ultimate decision-making process a good deal more rational and helpful.
Mr. Harrison, to follow up, Justice Harrison, it concerns me right now because we're saying the fitness to practice law, and I guess within that parameter, within that, is your relationship to your trust account part of your fitness to practice law? And so someone committing a theft, which might show lack of judgment, does that induce the fact that they'd be willing to pilfer from their trust account, since that's all the rage these days?
That one's much easier for me. Yeah, a theft or defalcation from a trust account, I wouldn't really care much whether it was a felony or a misdemeanor. And I think this change of rule gets you into something like that. I mean, it doesn't let the person go. We recently had, it's not a trust account, but we recently had a case of clear felony insurance fraud come into the office. But it was negotiated down to a state misdemeanor. And so it involving the insurance fraud, and therefore dishonesty and deceit, it was my view that that would get reported up here, and it would under either the existing rule or the new rule that we've proposed.
I have a question. The attachment to the petition deletes paragraph 9 of rule 111, unless I'm mistaken.
On page 4. I'm sorry.
Mine does not have numbers, but SCR 111 has paragraph 9 entitled Conviction for Other Than a Serious Crime. It's the red line that's attached to the petition.
Oh, it's the exhibit. Thank you. Yes, paragraph 9 deleted.
And there's a new paragraph 9, but
yes.
For my question to you, I'm saying paragraph 9 is the old one. I'm a little bit concerned that we're getting some slippage by the complete deletion of this, because I can envision a situation where, as the exchange you just had with Justice Hardesty suggests, serious crime or adversely affecting on a lawyer's fitness to practice law is to some extent in the eyes of the beholder. So I could see that we might get a petition that didn't warrant suspension, but nonetheless, we wanted to be sure it was referred for discipline and perhaps even ask whether this should be warrant a temporary suspension. And I'm concerned that we're losing that to where we're deferring the entire judgment of this to the state bar's characterization of the crime presented. Do you follow my comment?
I do, and certainly respect it. We only examined this issue because of recurring questions, some from the court, about why are you doing this? Okay. And I recognize that our substituting in a new process is not, as I said, a cure-all.
Yeah.
It frankly never occurred to me until Your Honor suggested it that if I saw a situation that looked like it warranted a petition to the court for temporary suspension, that this change, whether you make it or not, would cross my thinking in any event, because we'd still be looking at the immediacy question, we'd still be looking at the public safety question.
Yeah, I just want to make clear that we have the latitude. I think it needs some language tweaking. I don't know that we need to salvage all of paragraph 9, but 7 doesn't quite capture the latitude that 9 affords. So I think we probably need to get a little bit of language on that.
It was certainly no purpose of this to in any way instruct the courts looking at any situations, especially the ones on the edge. I mean, it's clear that that's your call. And, you know, if you see something in the newspaper about a misdemeanor conviction, you have had and will continue to have the right to ask the question, is this coming to us, or should it come to us?
Right. Thank you.
Further. Las Vegas, I understand Mr. Reedy would like to make some statements. Chris Reedy.
I'd ask you on 116, not on 111, which is presently before the court.
We want to talk about 116. Did you want to say anything about 116, Stan?
Again, this is sort of, if 111 is part of the incoming process, 116 is part of the outgoing process, both of which we were looking to make a little simpler, a little more objective. Perhaps I could use the phrase even a little more modern, because some of this language regarding reinstatement speaks to an earlier time about moral qualifications, etc. And I think what the language we borrowed for in 116 does is two things. One, it makes the lawyer's job easier, because as you know, at this point in the process, it is the lawyer who bears the burden of proof. So I think this tells that lawyer and the reviewing panel, even before it gets to you, with a little more precision and specificity, what it is that they're going to have to show. But again, there's no tectonic shift posed here about, say, changing the burden of proof in a reinstatement proceeding. It will still be with the respondent, or changing what you all have to find, that remains effectively the same, that this is not going to create an ongoing danger to the public or the courts or the profession. But it will make it easier and more efficient, I believe, for everybody to engage these issues with the new kind of vocabulary, if you will.
Any questions as to 116?
Just a quick question. Under this on Exhibit A, it's number two, procedure for reinstatement. Can you hear me okay, Stan?
If you could speak up a little.
I don't think my mic works, so I'll try to speak
okay.
up. Anyway,
that just come up.
Sure. So it's been amended somewhat to where the individual has met the following criteria, which I assume means all of them, and then you list them out. One that kind of I had a question about is the lawyer recognizes the wrongfulness and seriousness of the misconduct resulting in the suspension. Now, if you've gone into a contested matter and you come out of that, even though you've been disciplined and found in violation, but you still don't believe that you've done anything that was wrongful or of a serious misconduct, if they don't admit it, then are they still subject to being reinstated? Do you understand my question?
I do.
Oh. Okay. Did you? You know why? It's because of that case for you.
These criteria, like every word and every sentence, are have been endorsed by the Board of Governors. Been through that part of the process. Do I personally like them all in the form they're in now? Well, you know, you found one that is somewhat troublesome. I don't think that kind of thing is going to come up very often, but I can't say it will. Most of the cases, as you know, that come to you on the conditional guilty plea.
Right.
Therefore, we've taken care of that issue. Now, the respondent may not actually believe he did anything wrong or actually have remorse about it, but he signed off on the conditional guilty plea, so that's the...
And I see this in more of a hearing type situation where you have a contested hearing, and I'm just wondering if the, there's an ability to weigh these factors or if they're absolutes.
I read them as... The panel looks at them in terms of the case before them. For instance, there's reference here to alcohol or substance abuse and what's been done with the problem. Well, if alcohol and substance abuse didn't have anything to do with the problem, then the panel's got no business, you know, asking, have you been to a program, you know, are you getting medication? That's just, so I don't think all of these are going to apply to every case just because of the factual differences. But they're criteria to look at.
But that was just a concern I had.
Anything else? Anybody else on 116?
I think Justice Perigari has a fair point. I could see the way this is worded. It says that the applicant has the burden of demonstrating by clear and convincing evidence that he or she has met the following criteria. Alcoholism, okay, fine, they didn't have the problem, that's not going to apply. But this admission of the wrongfulness in a contested case where the applicant may feel aggrieved by the process and still denying that he or she did anything wrong, should they have to then pretend that they're admitting that they did something wrong as a condition of readmission? I think
I share that concern.
And
I don't think we would see it that often.
Right, but people read these and they parse them incredibly literally when they come to our court.
And everybody parses them differently as they go through the process. But I think maybe two little words like if applicable added somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, not going to cause any big change or weakening of what we're trying to do here.
Sure, I understand what the intent was.
I certainly don't you know, I can't speak for the board, but I can't imagine that that would make much of a difference. And you do want it to be, if applicable. I mean, we have had panels add to conditional guilty pleas a provision for going into a 12-step program or AA meetings when the respondent has not said, I have a problem. We have no evidence that there's a problem. And nobody has any evidence that there's a problem. And when we've raised that with them, they say, well, you know, we just thought we'd be safe. Well, no, that's not safe. That's overreaching, and it's a waste of time, so.
Yeah, thank you.
Does any other testimony here? How about in Las Vegas? Mr. Reed.
Chair.
Yes.
Christopher Reed, and I come before this court in an unusual position, not as a member of this court, but as a suspended member of the bar, directly impacted by Rule 116. In that capacity, I offer partial, tepid support to what Mr. Hunterman has proposed, but strong support for the purposes that he has just indicated. More specifically, anything that will add greater specificity, as the petition states, explicit criteria, obviously, I believe deserves great support. The problem comes, as Justice Perry-Gary pointed out, that this is brought before this court as an adoption of ADA Model Rule of Lawyer Disciplinary Enforcement 25, but it's actually a permutation of it. And I think it would benefit this rule if it included the language from Rule 25 as proposed by the APA. That concern that was just raised was, but what if they don't admit responsibility? And the ADA Rule 25 actually says a lawyer may be reinstated or readmitted only if the lawyer meets each of those following criteria, or, if not, presents good and sufficient reason why the lawyer should nevertheless be reinstated and readmitted, which would address that concern of where an attorney does not want to admit fault or does not believe they need to admit fault. They still can petition and they can show the good cause. The second issue that I have with the rule as proposed is, it isn't with the modification to Rule 116 subsection 2. It's how that modification needs to be correlated with language in 116 subsection 5. And this is the issue that Mr. Hunterton just brought up, of a panel on reinstatement adding additional conditions. Because Rule subsection 5 says that the panel on reinstatement has the authority to add any further condition deemed appropriate by the panel. The purpose of the rule before this court today is good in that it says, has the attorney explicitly met those criteria set forth by the panel on suspension and set forth by this court? We want a clear bar for that attorney to get over. I would encourage the bar and or this court in adopting the rule as proposed with the modified language to take that language out of subsection 5 that allows a panel on reinstatement to add additional conditions that were never part of the discipline original. And with that, I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. Mr. Hunter, did you want to respond to Mr. Reedy, or is there anything you want to add?
No.
Okay. Now let me ask you this. There's no way we can't conference on this because Justice Stiglitz had a previous engagement, so we can't conference today. There's talk about some of the amendments. Can you get some of the amendments to us as soon as possible? We can meet on this on the 14th or the 28th of November and finalize 111 and 116 with the comments by my colleagues. I leave it to you as to... Those are the dates, Ms. Brown?
Yes.
14th or the 28th?
Chief?
Yes.
If I might offer something along those lines, and it pertains to the hypothetical I posed, and this goes back to 111. The definition of serious crime, the way it's been suggested to be revised, actually, I think, addresses my concern, because what it now says is, which adversely reflects on the attorney's fitness to practice law, instead of involving and so forth, it says, or involves. So as long as the a gross misdemeanor or misdemeanor is raising improper conduct that affects the administration of justice, false swearing, misrepresentation, fraud, deceit, bribery, theft, then it seems to me that that covers it. I think we wouldn't, I wouldn't require any additional language with respect
anybody,
to
111. Anybody need any additional language on 111?
Yeah, I'd still like 9 tweaked, but not in a major way.
Yeah. Okay. So you tweak 9 and come up with the, if applicable, and the suggestions of Mr. Reedy as to whether you want to do those or not. It's up to, I leave it to you and then submit it to us.
I thought the language Mr. Reedy read from ABA Rule 25 sounded good as a setup, better than if applicable. But I haven't read the ABA rules, so
that's
I don't
why
know.
I figured I'd give them some time before we conference on it, so we'd have the language in front of us.
I don't know the politics of this having then to go back through the BOG.
I think we'll set this over to November 28th for us to conference on. If you can just get it to us, today's the 6th, so if you can get it to us in about 10 days, that gives us time to look at it.
They'll have a meeting within that period of time. If that's the
well, I think they...
Can you call a meeting? Is that going to be a hardship for you?
We have a meeting the day after tomorrow.
Oh, great. Yeah.
That's good.
That answers it. Thank you, Justice Barbary. That's good. Okay, is that good? So you understand what you need to look at?
Yes.
It seems some minor additions at this point. And it sounds like we're favorable.
To the court. Okay.
If you get before that so that we can take a look at it, and then when we conference, we may add a few things when we prepare the order. Great. Well, thank you. This matter will stand submitted, and we're in recess till tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.